Hey, everybody, this is Ted DiBiase, the Billion Dollar Man. You remember me? That's right. Everybody's got a price. And if you want to get your money's worth, then you need to stay right here and listen to the Gerwig Report with Steve Gerwig and Frank D.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. 'Cause the Million Dollar Man always gets his way.
It is Thursday, February the 12th, 2015. I am Steve Gerwig of Gerwig.net. That's www.gerwek.net. Gerwig.net, your source on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news. And welcome to the latest edition of the Gerwig Report podcast, where today we're going to welcome a very special guest. But first, let's say what's up to my longtime tag team partner, Frank D.
What's up out there, everybody? This is Frank D. Letting you know right now, you go to audibletrial.com/Gerwig.net and get a free audiobook today. Go to audibletrial.com/Gerwek.net, and boy, do we have a $1 million surprise for you today.
Absolutely, and technically speaking, a former WWF champion, a three-time WWF Tag Team Champion. He was the Million Dollar Champion, and today we welcome WWE Hall of Famer, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. How you doing today, sir?
Doing great, guys. How are you?
We're doing great. We definitely do appreciate your time. We've been trying to hook up with you for a while, and great to finally talk to you. How's everything going?
You're going very well. Staying busy. As I don't know, some fans know, most fans know. They've got two different websites. I've got a Million Dollar Man website, and I've got then Hardy David Ministry. I'm a minister now, and I spend a lot of my time traveling. That's one thing about my life that hasn't changed. Not nearly at the pace that I used to, but most weekends I'm somewhere, speaking for a church or doing something that's related to ministry. So that's pretty much become my life. And as I still make the occasional, autograph signing and, wrestling show appearance, but not as much of that as I am the other.
How are you doing physically these days?
Well, by and large, I think I'm doing pretty good. I had both my knees replaced. It's been 2 years now. That was like a new lease on life because I was dealing with a whole lot of pain for a while. And, I've had two surgeries on my neck. One was to fix a disc issue, two discs, herniated discs. And the second one was like a nerve impingement, which was not as big a deal. So I've had those surgeries. But aside from that, I've got my blood pressure is great. I don't have cholesterol issues. Most of the things that have bothered me are orthopedic in nature. And of course, I'm 61 years old now, so those things are, as you get older, those things are going to be a part of life anyway. But all in all, I'm in pretty good shape, considering the abuse I put my body through.
No, we posted on our Facebook page and Twitter that we're going to have the Million Dollar Man on, and we said, is there any questions you want us to ask the Million Dollar Man? And the most common one, probably the one you hear probably most often when you do interviews or maybe talk to fans is, you never won the WWE Championship or WWF Championship at the time. Any regrets, and do you feel like maybe politics played a role in you not getting that particular championship?
Well, here's the thing. Wrestling is show business. It's a storyline. It's a work. So are you really the world champion? Well, only on paper. And yes, obviously, the guys that are going to carry the world title are usually obviously need to be guys that can carry it. So there wasn't ever any doubt in anybody's mind that I was capable. Politics, I think, in that situation, and to some degree, I think had something to do with it. Only I didn't know about it at the time. What I was told was, the basic idea was that after the thing that we did at the Saturday Night Main Event, the twin referees, I buy the belt, and then they, obviously say you can't do that, and Andre wouldn't take the belt back because technically he won the match, and so we got to have this tournament to declare him champion. You know, the original plan was that I would somehow, you know, buy my way to the to that as well and end up winning that and then have to run with Hogan. And what I didn't know at the time was, you know, whatever the issue was, I know the Honky Tonk Man didn't want to drop the Intercontinental title to Randy Savage. And I don't know if it was an issue of trying to make everybody happy. I don't know. But basically, I was approached by Pat Patterson, and Pat asked me this question. He said, what is going to put more heat on the Million Dollar Man if we do what we originally talked about? Or, rather than you win the title and have the run, of course, the thing is, you have the run with Hogan, but, you know, yeah, by the time it's over, you know, you lose the belt and Hogan's champion again. That's the way it goes. And then they're on to the next guy. Or you don't win, and in your arrogance, you create your own title. And I just immediately answered, I said, that's it. Because I'm in this business to make money. What's going to make me more money? What's going to, you know, the more heat I have on me, it's like, you know, whether I'm in a title match or not with Hogan, I'm going to have a match. And here's a guy that's so arrogant that he's going to create his own title and parade it around. And really, the million-dollar belt made me more money than the world title belt would have. So the only regret, I would say, is, you know, because, you know, I was a guy who was in line for not only the WWF title, I was a guy that was also in line for the NWA World Championship, but I never got that either.
Wow.
And you know, and there's some politics in that, but by and large, the bottom line is, yeah, it would be nice that it would be nice if at some point I could have said I was a world champion. But again, it's a work. I mean, if, you know, did it hurt my career in any way that I wasn't? And I don't think so at all. So anyway, I hope that answers your question. I don't sit around, you know, pining over the fact that I wasn't, or saying, oh my gosh, I should have been, this should have happened, that should have happened. No, you know, I'm perfectly content with what did happen.
You know, Mr. DiBiase, you know, I've heard all these stories about Hulk Hogan, and you just brought him up there. What was your interactions like working with Hogan during that time frame in the WWF when the whole deal was going down with Andre and the twin referees? I mean, is Hogan really this big political force that everybody seems to think that he is?
Well, again, you know, you only know so much. I mean, he was the guy at the time. He was the man. And, you know, I would guess that it only makes sense that Vince is going to go with whoever Hogan's comfortable with, too, as, you know, who he's going to work with. And I know that, even though I didn't win the title, you know, post WrestleMania 4, for almost the whole next year, I traveled with Andre, and Andre and myself were in tag team matches almost every night with Hulk and somebody, whether it was Randy Savage or, you know, Beefcake or whoever. We did a lot of tag team, and I made a lot of money.
Right.
So, I've never had any problem with Hogan first. Not at all. I mean, everything that we've ever done has been up and up. You know, and I mean, and here's a guy who went through a lot of stuff too, you know. The whole deal with his family breakup and everything. And in regards to that, it's my understanding that he was the guy, he more than anybody tried to hold his family together.
Right.
You know, so I wish him well.
Now, I've heard you say, and I think you also wrote this in the book, about the development of the million-dollar character, that Vince came up with the character, and that you were cutting a promo one time and you did the laugh, and Vince says, yeah, this is the laugh you need for the gimmick. I just wondered, when you first heard about the million-dollar man gimmick, the idea, the development of the character, did you have any idea at all that it would become such a over-presence, a dominant character in WWF?
I really didn't. You know, I when Vince presented it to me, and, you know, I told Lester a lot too, and I got called away for a minute, and Pat Patterson looked at me and he said, Ted, he said, this is Vince's alter ego. He's basically, he's giving you a character that if he were going to be a character himself, this is it. You know, and he said, so, you know, think about that for a minute. Think about how hard he's going to push it. And And of course, you know, the 12 years that I've been getting to that place, you know, helped. I mean, the reason I was chosen, you know, he's, you know, one of the things he said, you're a great worker. You're very articulate. You know, you can do this. And I think, you know, the way that I carried myself as a heel anyway, you know, even before I was this million-dollar man, you know, I was kind of the aloof, I talked down to the fans type, you know, arrogant, I'm above you type of guy anyway. But now, you just add that, you know, call him the million-dollar man, and now it's just over the top, you know, like Snidely Whiplash with the, you know, and the whole deal. So, but again, the marketing, I mean, it's like when Vince looked at me and said, hey, we're gonna send you everywhere first class. You're gonna have limousine service every day. You know, there's only two other guys in the company at that time that got that kind of treatment. Hogan was one of them, and Andre was the other one. You know, and then, you know, things changed as it went along. If you were, you know, of course, the champion, but and all that stuff that was done simply, I mean, all that money, I gave away a lot of money just to get the. I mean, it was just. You know, we're going to make the public believe as much as we can that you're really this rich guy. So they spent a lot of money doing it. And, yeah, I mean, it was a wild ride. No, did I think that it would ever, you know, get that big or, you know, that I would end up in a place where, I mean, people say you're one of the icons of wrestling. No, I never anticipated that. And I'm just grateful, obviously, and I'm humbled. I'm a guy that grew up in the business and loved it, and always loved it. And, you know, I just feel fortunate that I had the run that I did.
You know, Ted, you had a run there with Michael Jones, Virgil, for a while there after the Royal Rumble, I believe the 91 Rumble. And how was that for you to go from having Virgil as your bodyguard and then working the match with him at WrestleMania 7?
Well, I mean, it wasn't easy, you know, and it's, you know, the thing about Virgil, you know, the guy, you know, for all practical purposes, a nice guy. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, didn't do drugs, never got in trouble, was always on time and things like that. Mike's a nice guy. He's just not real savvy. You know, he's just, if he'd had a better understanding of the psychology of the ring and wrestling. You know, if he could have been a bigger character, that could have been huge. But it was just one of those deals where, you know, we got as much out of it as we could. You know, it was one of those deals where I had to, and I hate to say that, but I mean, you know, I guess carry him and direct him all the time. And he, I never had any problems. I mean, he never developed an attitude. So, you know, I had no complaints about that. I mean, it's just, you know, if he'd have been a better wrestler, if he'd have had more savvy, then that could have, you know, he could have been a bigger star than he ended up being.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because over the years I've seen Virgil out there. You know, you see the stories of him out there trying to, I hate to say it like this, but panhandling the fans. As far as you see him at the train station, $20 autograph here. What's your relationship with him today, and what do you think when you see things like this or hear stories like that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's just kind of sad. You know, I don't know that he's ever been married, and I know for a long time he lived at home, you know, in the Pittsburgh area where he's from, and he lived at home with his mother. At least that's what he told me. And you know, I never see, you know, I've never known him to have a girlfriend. I mean, he never made any of that thing public. I mean, again, while he was on the road, I never saw him drink or take drugs or anything like that. So, you know, so like, unless he just was very poor money management, I mean, of course, you know, he wasn't making huge, huge money, but he was making a dang good living. So I don't know. I mean, and, he says, my understanding that he's like a substitute school teacher. You know, I don't know if that's true or not. I know that I do see the things. I mean, I see the stuff. It's almost comical. I mean, you'll see. You know, what was that time? Was it they said it poor Virgil or something? I don't know what they called it.
But like lonely Virgil.
Lonely Virgil, where you see all these places that is faithful, and of course there's a big sign behind him, and my figure dominates the sign.
Yeah.
and it's Million Dollar Man and Virgil, yet the Million Dollar Man's nowhere to be found, you know. So,
right.
But, you know, some guys would just be all up in arms and say, you know, well, you know, it's, as long as he doesn't false advertise, in other words, as long as he doesn't tell people we're both going to be there and then he's the only guy that shows up, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Well, you know, then that would make, that would anger me because then he's, you know, taking advantage of me. But I've never known him to do that. And it's just, and the guy's got to make a living. I just, you know, I feel like it's just sad.
Yeah.
It's just sad. I don't have any animosity towards him. I don't, you know, I don't see him very often. But every now and then somebody will book us both in for an autograph sign, and I'm fine with that. You know, just, you know, but there was a time when I had to give him a call and say, look, because I think, you know, he was getting to where he would see that I was booked somewhere and call the promoter and, like, try to, you know, get himself booked. And, you know, that's not good business. And so I just, you know, I told him, I said, look, if you want to be on a show that you see me on, call me. Call me first, and if it's cool, then great. You know, come on. And because, you know, the two of us together, you know, we do pretty good at autograph signings even now. So, there's no animosity. I mean, if there's anything, just a little bit of a, just, you know, more than, I guess that's just kind of like, I feel sorry for the guy.
What did you first think when you heard the theme song and you developed the theme song, the Million Dollar Man theme song? Was it, did you know that was really going to work and that was going to click? Because, I mean, when I think of you, I always think of that theme song now, and it's just one of the, like, most famous wrestling themes out there.
The thing about the song, I tell you, you know, Jimmy Hart wrote the music for all of those songs. He wrote Hogan's song, my song. I mean, all those early theme songs, that was all Jimmy Hart. I don't know if you guys knew that. I mean, you guys know the story on Jimmy Hart. You know, I can't remember, what was the name of that band he was
Gentry's.
Part of? Who was it?
Gentry's.
Gentry's.
Yeah, the Gentry's, you know. Keep on Dancing. I still remember that song. But Jimmy Hart was the guy, you know, and he developed that thing, and we went somewhere, and of course, you know, it's, you know, me on the deal, and obviously I'm not singing. I couldn't carry a tune with the handles on it, but I got a big kick out of it. You know, I was thinking I was going to get something really, I don't know. I don't know what I thought I was going to get. But, when, you know, like the first time I heard it, I was like, man, okay. But then the more I heard it, I guess, oh, now when I hear it, I want to, you know, how many times am I going to hear that song?
Yeah.
I've been hearing it for 20 years now. Give it a break.
I want to put you a little bit on the spot. You had a great run with Dr. Dusty Williams as a tag team. Obviously, Mike Rotundo we saw in WWF. And I remember your tag team with Stan Hansen. Do you have a favorite tag team partner looking back at your career?
You know, I can't say that I have a favorite. I mean, because, I mean, literally, I made money with all of those guys. I mean, you know, Stan Hansen was probably one of the biggest names in pro wrestling in Japan ever. I mean, I would say right there, I mean, I don't know, as far as a foreign wrestler, he was probably the premier guy, you know, and just right behind him, I would say Terry Funk's a close second. But, you know, when Hansen approached me, because up until that time, Bruiser Brody had been his partner, and Brody was going over to the other company, and he said, I need a new partner, do you want the job, you know, and I was like, are you serious? I was like, yeah, of course I want the job. You know, it's the Pope of Catholic. Are you kidding me? And so, you know, that was a great run. And of course, the Japanese style is different, so it wasn't work. It wasn't a tag team like, you know, the normal thing. It was a lot more. I don't know. It's just the matches are they're a quicker pace, and you know, it's just. I don't know, they're not as scientific, I guess. At least they weren't then. Especially with Hansen. With Stan, it was like sometimes you never knew what he was going to do, you know, even if you were his partner. But Steve Williams, I mean, I helped Steve when he first broke in. Bill Watts kind of gave Steve and me to help groom him. And, you know, talk about a guy who came around and was just a wonderful guy and, you know, a wonderful person. And, I mean, you talk about a phenomenal athlete. I mean, you know, at his funeral, his wrestling coach said that, I think it was Bruce Bumgarner, if I'm not mistaken, who won the Olympic gold medal, and they wrestled each other in college. He said that, if Steve Williams had been a one-sport athlete in college, in other words, if he had not played football and wrestled, which is unheard of, he said, I'd never beat him. Because he realized if Steve had concentrated on nothing but wrestling, he'd have been a better wrestler. But here's a guy who actually competed in, you know, in both football and wrestling in a college level. And that's just incredible. Because, you know, most guys today, you pick your sport and that's it. But to compete in two different sports on the college level is just incredible. That's the kind of athlete Steve was. So, and I loved him, and I was heartbroken when he died. I mean, he still had so much to live for. And then Mike Rotunda, my gosh, I mean, you know, he couldn't find a nicer guy. He couldn't find a nicer guy, and he knows the business. He's got great psychology, and we gelled extremely well together. And you never know that when you put two guys together, but we did. I guess it's, you know, because we both came up in the same school, so to speak, in terms of, you know, our belief and our psychology of the business, you know how that heel team should work. So I can't say that I could. It'd be, you know, I'd have to just say, you know, I love them all. There's not one that sticks out.
You know, Ted, one of the things I wanted to always know was the Undertaker always supposed to be the mystery partner in the Elimination Match of Survivor Series 1990? And have you seen Taker lately? I mean, we've heard the reports that his health is not very good. I mean, have you had any kind of conversations lately with Undertaker? And do you think he's going to be back in time for WrestleMania 31 this year?
Well, you know, I knew, and, you know, oftentimes I've been used as the catalyst for other guys. And so, you know, with the heat that I carried, you know, the best person for Vince to put the Undertaker with to introduce him, you know, if they're going to introduce him as you know, as obviously a heel, and they did, was to put him with me. And, you know, I was impressed from the beginning because the timing in wrestling is essentially everything. And to be that character, you know, this, like the dead man, so to speak, to lay there and to sit up like he did and to move almost in slow motion, if you will. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And yet had to develop a timing to make it click. You know, I was very impressed with Mark from the beginning. And, of course, you know, did I have any idea at the time that, you know, that he would be that big? No. I don't think anybody realized that. But he just got better as it went. And, you know, I still remember, I think the first big blowout entrance that he did was when we did SummerSlam. In 93 in Chicago, and they had the Druids and the whole deal, the fog, and I actually got to see that entrance from the ring as I was standing there. That was the Undertaker versus the Undertaker.
Yeah.
Undertaker. And, but yeah, he is the phenom, that's for sure. And a good friend. I haven't seen him, you know, the last time I saw him was at WrestleMania, and I still don't know, you know, all the questions happened last year. I have no idea. You know, I wasn't in the back. I don't know what was supposed to happen. And, you know, personally, you know, I mean, you know, I was kind of shocked. It's like, you know, I can't tell. I mean, with the look on everybody's face, I almost felt like it wasn't supposed to happen that way, that maybe he got knocked out. You know, and I was told the stuff that they said that, you know, he even, you know, collapsed when he got behind the curtain. I don't know. I have no idea because I wasn't there. But, you know, the controversy about that swarms. Personally, you know, it's kind of like if I were going to beat The Undertaker, I would, if I was going to do it, I would do it with someone that you're really trying to build. Kind of like when Andre, you know, did the job for Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 3. He passed the torch, you know, then Hogan became the guy.
Can you talk about your son, obviously Ted DiBiase Jr., we saw on WWE television, and I think he had a good run there for a time, and he was, of course, teaming with Cody Rhodes for a time. And what happened with your son, Ted Jr., and is there any chance we could see him in the future maybe returning to the business?
Well, I was thinking, you know, never say never, but, you know, the truth is I didn't want my boys to be wrestlers, not because I didn't love the business. I mean, I grew up in the business, but, you know, my dad didn't want me to be a wrestler either, and it wasn't until I was bitten in it until I understood it. And it's not the wrestling. You know, it's you know, what you take on in the lifestyle. You know, if you're a single guy, great, but, you know, it's a very hard business to live in and be married. You know, because there's all kinds of temptations out there. And to the company's credit, the accountability that they have in place now, the really stringent drug testing policy, that helps. And, you know, not only that, but we were, you know, back when this thing was just growing, the amount of time that we were gone, that we were on the road and just away from our families was just, you know, it was insane. So, you know, we're doing a documentary about my life and my ministry right now. And the title of the thing is The Price of Fame. And oftentimes the price of fame is just that, you know, sometimes it ends up being your family. But as far as Ted Jr. goes, he figured it out. He figured it out. You know, he was getting a good push. And then, you know, after, you know, that first WrestleMania appearance, actually that was the year I was inducted. In 2010, and he was tagged up with Cody, and a lot of people think they should have left him together for a while, whatever. I don't know, but I know this: I know that by the time his wife gave birth to their first son, and made me a grandpa, he called me and he said, "Dad," he said, "you were right." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know." You know, if I, you know, 4 days on, 3 days off, you know, that's okay. But to be a star in this business, the time required is not worth it. Because the amount of time I have spent away from my wife and my child, he says, it's just not worth it, you know, at any price, you know. And so I said, well, you get it. And so when his contract came up, you know, and a lot of people think they let him go. They didn't let him go. They wanted to re-sign him. And he just declined, you know, so... you know, and he didn't leave mad or with an attitude. He said, thank you very much for the opportunity. And now he's become somewhat of the entrepreneur, got a lot of things going. I don't have time on an interview to tell you all the stuff he's doing, but, you know, I just say this, there's a good chance that, because people will say to me, oh, DiBiase, the $1 million man, I said, well, on television, but the real $1 million man is probably going to be my son.
Wow.
Yeah, he's doing well.
Can you talk about your other sons? I know all three of them did try to get into wrestling. I remember Brett was in the developmental territory for a while. Are any of them active at all in wrestling these days?
No, Brett had four knee surgeries and a neck fusion in 2 years.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And, of course, a lot of that was because he was trying to do stupid things that I told him not to do. And, you know, he learned the hard way. But, you know, he's back home now. He's got a regular job, and he's got a wife, and he's also made me a grandfather. I got a one-year-old grandson that's Brett's boy, and so they're doing good. My oldest son, Michael tried it for a little while, and then, he blew out his knee, but he never actually, you know, he blew out his knee before he ever got to the WWE's developmental program. So nobody in wrestling. And I'm okay with that. And I don't want that to be misunderstood either. I think that the WWE's done a tremendous job. I mean, everything evolves and everything grows. I know that their drug testing policy, I mean, and I'm one of those guys. You know, I've never had an addiction to drugs or alcohol. But I get the same letter everybody gets, and they send it out annually. You know, and anybody that's ever worked for them, and that letter basically says if you're dealing with some form of substance abuse and you need help, we will help you. WWE will take care of you and get you through it. And that's you know, So I'm not down on the WWE. I'm just saying, and when guys ask me, I go, you know, like the $1 million man said, everybody's got a price. I said, well, everything has a price. One, you know, the price of fame, you know, you get oftentimes, you know, it's like you, it's one of those things, it's like do it while you're young. You know, get in there and do it, and you know, and do it while you're single, because the toll it's going to take on you and your family, you know, it's like 90%, you know, at one time. I don't know what it is now, but I can say 90% of the guys that came into this business married and didn't leave that way. So, and all those demons, and of course, we're all, you know, we all have to live with the consequences of the choices we make. You know, so WWE's done everything they can, in my opinion, to, you know, bring accountability, you know, in terms of the drug testing, and, you know, here are the consequences if you decide to go that way. You know, here's the deterrent, you know, and for, you know, they only work 4 days a week now. Of course, if you're a top star, and of course, you're going to be well paid for it, you know, I mean, I've heard stories, even interviews or read or something like that, where he was talking about, you know, how many days he's gone, which is just insane. But he's constantly promoting the WWE. And, you know, that's okay. But, you know, again, if I'm not mistaken, I think John Cena's also a divorced guy now. So there you have it. You know, that's, you know, I don't regret my boys trying. Simply because if I'd have said no, absolutely not, I'm not going to support you, and I'm going to be mad as heck at you if you ever even consider doing that, then I would have driven a wedge in the relationship I had with my sons. I understood that it's just one of those things they're going to have to figure it out on their own. And every one of them would come back to me right now and say, yeah, you were right, Dad. You know, and they're glad they're where they're at. So, but again, never say never. You never know what might happen in the future. I don't know. But I know this. There's no burning desire in the hearts of any of my children to be in the ring. They're very happy being at home with their wives.
Fair enough. You participated years ago in a WWE production called The Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior. And you had some interesting comments at the time to say about Warrior and his career in the WWE. And I wanted to ask you, during the WrestleMania 30 weekend Hall of Fame ceremony, of course, last year, Warrior got inducted. Did you ever get a chance to talk to Warrior, to try to mend the fence, to try to work things out with Warrior, or is this something that didn't happen?
Well, it didn't happen, and I regret that. I actually, when the induction ceremony itself was over, you know, and we were filing out of there, I started to go then. I thought, you know, I'm going to go and bury this hatchet. And because, I mean, I'm a man of the word, you know. And basically, as a Christian, I tell people all the time, I said, you know, forgiveness isn't optional. It's like, you know, God commands us to forgive. You know?
Right.
Because, you know, we've all been forgiven. And but then I thought for a minute, I said, you know what, this isn't, you know, right now he's just been inducted into the Hall of Fame, his wife, his daughters, you know, his mother there. I mean, this is his hour, you know, and with the relationship that we have had, you know, I'm probably the last guy he wants to come around the corner right now. But I said, there's the rest of the week, and this was like, you know, the show was the next day. And unfortunately, it never happened. It just, you know, things got busy, and I was doing stuff, and he was doing stuff, and it just never happened. And I regret that. I tip my hat to the company for their willingness to, you know, bury the hatchet, because, you know, I mean, all those things, but that's not to say that all the things that were said by all the people on that DVD, you know, those are things that really happened. So, you know, there was reason, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't know a whole lot about Jim. And during his induction speech, when he said that his father had abandoned them when he was very young, that was my answer. There's the source of all his anger. There was the source of what I think made him the way he was. and it was that anger, because I talk about that all the time. I do a lot of, I speak to a lot of men specifically, and I guess biblically speaking, you know, the Bible calls upon men to be the spiritual leader in their home before they're everything, before they're the breadwinner. You know, that every child needs the affirmation or the dad. You know, I go and I speak in a lot of prisons, and I've lined up guys that were hardcore, tattooed, bald-headed, all muscled up, look like they just sit and slit your throats, look at you. And I've said this to them, I said, a lot of you guys have never had a dad that said they cared about you or said you were worth anything. I'm going to take the place. You know, because there's a God that loves you unconditionally. And said he'd never leave you nor forsake you. And it's just incredible, you know, these guys come up, and I said, I'm going to give you that affirmation if you want it. If you want that hug your dad never got. I mean, I'm a 61-year-old guy now. And, the time that I did this, I was really taking a chance. I didn't know it was going to happen. Somebody said I was going to, but it was amazing. They lined up, and every one of those guys, to a man, when they took that hug, they just wept. And I said, well, and so, I mean, back to Warrior, when he said that, that gave me an insight as to the source of his anger and why he had that kind of, you know, somebody said he'd read the book, The Art of War, you know, and in war there are no rules, just win, take no prisoners. So, you know, if I've got to step on you to be a success, then so be it. You know, he's like, that's the natural thing to do. And yet I grew up in the wrestling business, and as I grew up, and then we're a family, and we're working together. We're working together to entertain the crowd, and we're working together, and we have to rely on each other, and it's my obligation. I mean, one of the first things I was taught, that my first priority is to make sure that the guy I'm working with doesn't get hurt. In other words, if something happens and you slip, you know, if you've got to spend yourself to keep your opponent from getting hurt, then do it. And as long as that's that was obviously not Jim's mindset. And of course, you've heard the stories. I mean, you know, holding up Vince and all that stuff. And, you know, and Vince treated him like a son. I mean, really. So, but again, it goes back to the source of it, you know, in Jim's young life. Apparently, he didn't have a dad. Of course, nobody knew that because he never was around. He never opened up to anybody. And it made, you know, and it made it even harder for people to like him. But when the company called me and asked me to go and be one of the guys on the, they did a whole week of tribute to Warrior.
Right.
And they asked me, do you want to do this? I said, absolutely. I said that on the segment that I did. I said, you know, some of you people may be surprised to see me here, because you know of the past. I said, I'm here to honor the Warriors' career today. And I didn't get that chance, and I do regret it. And I'm glad you asked that question. I think it helps the fans understand that there wasn't. I didn't have the attitude towards Warrior because there was no reason. The whole thing was the company's willingness to say, okay, let's put this behind us. And I was right along with that, you know. I was all about that. I just, because of the feelings we had towards each other, on the night of the actual event, I said, let him have his hour. And of course, I thought there's going to be another time. Are you kidding? You know, even if it's next year. Well, shoot. You know, nobody had any idea that, you know, just a couple of days later he'd be gone. That's really sad. But you know what? As sad as it is, it makes me feel good to know that one of the last things that his wife and his daughters saw him do was be honored for his career.
Absolutely.
So anyway, there you have it, guys.
Couldn't agree with. I mean, you said it right there. I mean, his family was able to see him be honored, and then, you know, the guys that he was able to bury the hatchet with. I mean, that's just like, you know, when you think about life and death, and you know, the spiritual aspects of it, it's just like that was to me, that was just like, that was the last thing he was supposed to do, was supposed to come and you know,
yeah.
be, you know, set, you know, people to be, you know, look back at his career and him being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and then the Lord took him. He had a bigger plan.
Yeah.
That's how I saw that. I mean, that's how I look at it.
Oh, yeah. And again, I, with all sincerity, I couldn't have, you know, I couldn't have been happier that they did it, you know, I would reiterate what you just said. Yeah, and again, I just, you know, in the moment, you know, and I do. I do regret that. It's just like, gosh, you know. And I mean, and I'll be honest with you, I said, never again if I feel something. Instead of, you know, say, okay, I'll do it tomorrow, I'm not going to put it off. I'll never put it off again, you know, because that's something that I really would have liked to have done, you know. Is to, you know, pat the guy in the back and tell him I was happy for him and put it away. But we just never got the chance. But
while we're on the subject of wrestling deaths, we do have a question. We've seen certainly a lot of great superstars pass way before their time. I mean, we just celebrated the, 12th anniversary of the passing of Mr. Perfect, which is hard to believe that Kurt Hennig's been gone for 12 years now. But somebody had a question. Has there been any death in particular that affected you the hardest? I mean, we sometimes hear about, you know, somebody passed away, and a lot of times it's way before their time. But is there one death that you can think of that really affected you the hardest?
Well, I would guess the obvious answer would be my dad.
Your dad,
You know, my dad, you know, died as a result of, I mean, you know, had anything to do with the match, but he had a heart attack while he was wrestling.
Right.
In Lubbock, Texas. July 69, and of course that impacted me tremendously. But you know, since that time going forward, the one guy that passed away, that is one of those things where I, you know, the last time I saw him, I never dreamed that I would see him again, was Andre. You know, when Andre, you know, when his father died, he went back to France, buried his dad, and then, you know, went to sleep that night and never woke up. You know, that, you know, I just, he's one of those guys that I wish I'd had the opportunity to, you know, just see him again, because we were friends. He was a great guy. You know, another guy who passed away unexpectedly, who helped me a lot in my young career, was a guy named Dick Murdoch. You know, another guy, he's another guy that, you know, Dick, you know, went home one afternoon, laid down on his couch to take a nap, and he didn't wake up.
Mm.
And he was pretty young. I mean, you know, I don't think he wasn't, I mean, my gosh, he's been gone a long time. I don't even know if he was 50. So, Kurt Hennig was a surprise for everybody, I think, you know, because, you know, it's kind of like, you know, there's guys on the flip side of that, you know, that things that are sad. Jake Roberts, you know, Jake Roberts, one guy who everybody thought would be dead by now.
Yeah.
As of the abuse that he's, you know, put his body through, and I couldn't be prouder of Jake for the turnaround that he's done. I mean, I can't tell you how happy I am for that guy. You know, but it was the thing with Kurt, was one of those things. It wasn't like Kurt was not like a horrible addict who just. It was one of those things where it was like he let his hair down one time and it killed him. You know. So that was kind of, that was very sad, you know, and my other son Brett was, you know, down there in the training cell at the same time as his son, Joe, and I got to know Joe, and my other son on numerous occasions, you know, shared some funny stories about his dad with him, and just that, you know, just to see that, you know, like, I could see when I would come down there to visit my son, you know what I'm saying? They were friends, but there were times when I could tell, it's like, you know, he's going, man, you know, I wish this was my dad. I wish he could come down here. So, yeah, that, you know, Henning's death was, that was another one. It hit me pretty hard.
Another guy that we lost too soon was Macho Man Randy Savage, who is going to be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame this year, rightfully so, long overdue. And, you know, I want to ask you, Ted, you know, you worked a lot with Savage back in the WWF, and I just wanted to ask you, how was the Macho Man, and why do you think it took so long for WWE to induct him, and do you know of any heat that he possibly had with Vince McMahon?
Well, you know, there's always hear all kinds of stuff, and, you know, some that I wouldn't even repeat because it sounds so silly to me. But the one thing, I don't know, if I'm not mistaken, there was one thing where I think Randy had said, you know, if he were inducted in the Hall of Fame, he wanted to go in with his brother and his dad. It was almost like that. I think that was one of his stipulations or something. And I know that got waived, or maybe his brother is, you know, like just said, forget that. You know, I mean, he deserved to be in there. As far as my relationship with Randy, you know, Randy was a constant pro, man. I really enjoyed working with him. And he was, you know, he was always on time. He was always about business. And it was funny because, you know, like me, he grew up in the business yet. He was a guy who kind of liked to map things out. You know, a lot of us older guys, you know, when it came to the match, it's like, tell me the finish, and then I'll take care of the rest when I get there. And Randy was one of those guys who kind of liked to map it out. And so I learned to do that. But, you know, I said, now, Randy, you know, I understand. I said, we're going to do this basic game plan here, but if I get an idea, something comes to me while we're in the ring in the moment, he said, oh, yeah, brother, don't worry about it. We'll do it. we call it doing the dance. And then we danced well together. And I was sad. I mean, because I know Lanny, and, you know, I had recently seen Lanny somewhere. We were together, asked him about Randy, and he said, man, he said, Ted, he's happy again. He had been recently married, and he's doing well and enjoying life, and he's happy. And I said, that's great. And then the next thing I hear is he has a heart attack at the wheel, and off the road, hits a tree, and he's gone. So, yeah, I'm very happy to see that he's being inducted this year. I believe it's long overdue, but hey, it's better late than never.
Talked in other interviews about the disorganization of WCW. I just wondered if you, looking back at your career, and certainly you were part of the NWO, one of the most popular angles, and I think that angle brought back so many wrestling fans that had been kind of upset with wrestling and had played out, and you came back and you were an essential character in that group at one time. But looking back, do you kind of regret maybe going to WCW? Maybe I should have stayed with WWF at the time?
Yeah, well, there's another thing. It's like it's all part of my story. When I initially left the WWF after SummerSlam in 1993, the real reason that I was leaving then was I had to separate myself from the environment, because I was kind of like, if you're an alcoholic, then you better stay out of the bar, right?
Right.
And not that I, you know, drink one, but I was in an environment that was going to, if I didn't separate myself from it, was going to, you know, do its best to suck me back in. You know, back then, it was like, you know, we're on the road all the time, and it's the next town, the next, you know, the next show, the next party. And, you know, for me, the danger was, I don't want to fall back into this. And that's really why I left. And then when I came back as a manager and a commentator. And it didn't require me to be on the road all the time. The managers didn't go on the road. They just went to television. They did the TV shows. And I was a commentator, so I was in the studio one day a week. And then Vince decided to put me back on the road to help groom a couple guys. One of them was Ted, and then that guy was Steve Austin. So, and I, you know, what I should have done, and later Vince and I had this conversation, but I should have gone to Vince at the time, and I should have just told him. See, me going back on the road was, you know, I didn't want to do it. I didn't want it because the road at that time still represented danger to me, and I didn't want to for that reason. But I said, here's a guy running a company, his business. You know, he doesn't get three nickels. Why I don't want to be on the road, and so I left the WCW because I could do the same thing there. I could be the manager, and I could be the announcer from time to time. And I was only there one day a week, and at the pay-per-views and special events. But Vince and I got to have that conversation, and I admitted to him, I should have come and talked to you. And we buried that hatchet some time ago. But yeah, you know, in reality, if I had stayed and had a conversation with Vince, I don't know what exactly would have happened, but I think I'd have been with the company the entire time. And it was, WCW was just, it was just probably the most ill-run and least organized companies that I ever worked for. Just, it was just horrible. I mean, there Monday nights, you know, the show's going on live, and they're still not sure what they're going to do in the last segment. That was crazy. And of course, by now I wasn't wrestling, so I'm not like, I'm not the central figure, and I guess Bischoff saw his, you know, he saw how this thing was getting over, and he saw where he could introduce himself into that thing as the mouthpiece, right? And essentially take the spot that he hired me for. And I eventually told him that to his face. I said, look, I said, this isn't an ego thing. I said, Eric, I said, you hired me to be the voice of this thing. And I said, now I'm walking out there every week. You're talking, they're talking, and I'm standing in the corner hanging on to, Hulk's belt. I said, I'm not Virgil. I said, I'm not going to spend my career, being a belt bearer for Hulk. You know, and I said, that has nothing to do with ego. That has everything to do with business. And he said, you're right. And so I went home, and then they brought me back. When they brought me back, you know, they brought me back as a babyface manager for the Steiners. I guess that's because I had started speaking on Christian television and what have you. And I didn't think that was really the wisest thing to do either. But, you know, I was under a 3-year guaranteed contract. So I said, well, you know, do what you want. And tell them it's been over. And when it was over, I had no intention of re-signing with them.
One of the things that I will say about your run at WCW, being a fan at the time there, was it was kind of crazy as a fan to see, you know, you had come from the WWF, and I remember back in the late 80s, you were Hogan's enemy, you and Virgil. And then to see you come out as Trillionaire Ted, and you're siding with Hogan, and you're part of the NWO, I thought it was cool. And I will agree with you that I don't think you should have been replaced as the mouthpiece of the group. I think that when Bischoff came in, to me, it really started the decline of the NWO, because it was fine the way it was. I mean, you were out there, you were interviewing Hogan, and then, you know, Virgil was, Vincent, the head of security. I thought they had magic there. And then they brought you back as the babyface manager for the Steiner Brothers, and then subsequently after that, you were gone. I really thought that sucked, personally.
Yeah. Well, by that time, I didn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is what it is, gentlemen.
Yeah. Even Bischoff said, you know, he says, well, maybe I was a little too involved. Yeah, you were too involved. I mean, just what you were saying there, you know, Mr. DiBiase, about you going out there and Bischoff was interviewing Hogan and you're standing in, yeah, you were standing in the background. I remember I was just watching it the other day. You were standing in the background with Vincent with the belt. You know, you were no longer the money man behind the group, and that's what made it work. You know, you were the money man behind the NWO. That's what made it work to me. And it just, I don't know. It's just like a lot of things about WCW, I will never understand.
Yeah, well, that's wrestling.
Yeah.
That about sums it up.
Pretty much.
I just wonder, Mr. DiBiase, with your schedule, do you get a chance to watch the today's product, and just what's your overall opinion of today's wrestling products?
You know, I really don't. It's kind of like people ask me that all the time, and I go, well, look, you know, I said, if you'd been a doctor for 30 years, would you go home every day and watch Dr. Oz? I mean,
yeah.
It's like, you know, it's not, if I happen to be home and I'm free and I'm not doing something else, I'll watch. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, here's the way I look at it. Everything evolves. Everything does. And, you know, like when kids come to me for advice today, I said, you know, it's hard for me to tell you and give you really good advice. It's because the wrestling, the industry that is there today is not the same industry that I was in. It's not the same anymore. And, you know, even, you know, I know Vince has an emphasis on not calling his talent wrestlers, but calling them, you know, entertainers or superstars. You know, and And I get that, you know, because the explosion of the WWE, I mean, you know, it was almost like Vince was his worst enemy, because when he got that big and all these other little companies couldn't compete with him, they went out of business. Well, that's where his initial talent came from. You know, all those little territories were the farm teams. Those were the, you know, like the minor leagues for baseball. You know, those were where the stars of the future were getting groomed, and now there is no place. And, you know, and that's the thing. To learn the business I was in the way I learned it, you know, it was like it was an acquired skill over a period of time. This is getting in front of my crowd and doing it every night and developing your own character and developing a feel for the crowd and all those things, so that when that time came, you know, when I went to the WWF, I was ready, you know, and so that's been taken away from a lot of these young guys now, because there's now it's a school, and you know, they gotta look for their raw talent, you know. Sometimes in these indies, and you know, there's I guess you got, I'm sure you guys would agree, there's a lot more bad indies than there are good ones. There are a few good ones, and that's a good thing. But it's just, you know, it's just not the same anymore. It's not, and that's what the older fans, the fans that watched me, the fans who weren't my fans, they say those things. They go, well, you know, it's just not the same anymore. You know, there's more talk than there is action. And I go, well, you're right. I said, they still have a tremendous fan base. I mean, you know, they're still global. I mean, it's like, you know, they're a bigger company today than when I was there. You know, so I don't want to be one of those guys that comes along and says, you know, I don't want to be one of those old guys. All these young guys, they don't know what they're doing. You know, I might not say that. It's a different business. And I want them to have success, because, you know, personally, for what I'm doing now, the more success the WWE has, and the more in the public they are, then, you know, the more opportunity for people to remember who I was and to maybe, you know, book me at their church or do an event type of thing. Because, you know, that's what I really, you know, I don't give three nickels without being famous. All the fame does for me now is it opens doors of opportunity for me to share the gospel.
Do you have the WWE Network? Do you watch that at all?
You know, I have the network. I do. But I'll be honest, I couldn't tell you anything that's going on right now, because I'm so entrenched and involved in the other things that I'm doing. I just don't know. I mean, you know, it's like I was there at WrestleMania last year. You know, and the guy that I was the most impressed with was my old partner's son.
Artunda.
Bray.
Bray Wyatt.
Bray Wyatt. You know, he showed a lot of talent, and I couldn't tell you. I mean, I really couldn't tell you right now, because I haven't been watching. And it's not because I don't want to, or it's just, that's life. It's like, wrestling doesn't identify who I am. If you understand what I'm saying, you know, it's like I'm not just holding on to that. Like, I had my run. I'm happy with what I had. Because people ask me, and I'll say, don't you wish you were still there? Don't you wish you could have made, you know, been one of those guys on a $1 million contract? And I said, you know what? Everything happens for a reason. I said, I'm very happy with where I'm at. You know, and I'm content. You know, I'm not, God bless you, I'm not Ric Flair.
Oh yeah.
He climbed right back in there. And I tell you what, I guarantee you, he's in shape. You know, to his credit, he's in shape. But God bless him, man. He's the guy who never wants to quit being, you know, the Woo Man.
Yeah. With all the DVD releases that WWE has put out over the years, I came to the realization, looking at my own DVD collection, that I don't have a $1 Million Man DVD set.
They started working on one, and then they stopped. And they, I don't know, I mean, I guess a lot of the stuff that I did prior to working with them was with, you know, Mid-South. Well, now they have the entire Mid-South, you know, all Mid-South stuff, so I don't know. I know the guys had done interviews for it, the whole deal, and, you know, they say, you know, well, you know, sooner or later it'll get out there. So I don't know. You know, I knew that they were working on one, and then I guess it, you know, got put on hold because they felt like they didn't have enough footage on me from other territories. And that's because in reality, I probably worked more for Bill Watts, you know, in the first 12 years of my career than at anybody. So there wasn't a whole lot that they could get anywhere else anyway. So anyway, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I guess probably eventually it'll come out. I don't know.
At what point did you guys really realize that the Ringmaster gimmick was not going to work for Steve Austin, that Steve needed to go in a totally different direction?
Well, by the time he did that, I wasn't there. But I remember telling Steve, because I think some of the agents, or they call them producers now, or they were telling him that he needed to do more in the ring, and his matches needed to have more energy or something, I don't know. And basically, I told him, I said, Steve, I said, don't change anything. That's what I told him. I said, you're unique. I said, you have a very rugged style, and you're very believable. And I said, that's something that a lot of these, and I even said it then, I said, some of these young guys come into the business don't understand this. Because they think because everybody already knows the show that it doesn't matter whether it looks that way or not. I said, but the more believable you can be, the better. The better you're going to be get over. And I said, you're believable. I said, so it's going to take you longer maybe than somebody else. But I said, once you're over, you're over. Then you can do whatever you want to, And of course, nobody had any idea at that time how over he would get. But yeah, when I left there, he hadn't become Stone Cold yet.
Do you ever envision yourself maybe someday going back to WWE? I mean, if Vince calls you tomorrow and says, hey, Ted, come back as a commentator, or Ted, we got this young kid. Can you help groom him? Can you be his manager? Would that be something you'd entertain, or do you kind of feel like you're just, from a full-time standpoint, done with wrestling?
Well, I really feel like that from a full-time standpoint that I'm done. I mean, obviously, I don't think anybody should never say never. But, I did go back for about a year and a half in 2005 and early 2006. And I did work behind the scenes. And quite frankly, I didn't enjoy that because it was kind of like, what I realized is it is a different business. And, I don't know, a lot of the advice I was giving them was going to be sound advice. I'm not a guy who, I never diagrammed matches. I never did that. How can I sit down and do something with somebody? I said, that's so foreign to me. Even Vince looked at me one night and he said, you know what, Teddy, you remind me of Ray Stevens. And I said, why is that, Vince? And he said, well, Ray Stevens was undoubtedly one of the greatest workers we ever had. And he said, so are you. He said, but if you ever asked Ray why he did what he did in a match, he couldn't really explain it to you. And I said, exactly. And I said, because it all came by feel. And that's hard to explain. It's an innate. It's an intangible gift. It's, you just get in a situation and you go, okay, let's do this, it'll work. And I don't know, and that's who I am. So, I tried to tell him the first day, I said, I'm not Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood's good on both sides of the camera. I said, you tell me what the story is, and I can go make the story happen. But don't ask me to write the story. You know what I'm saying? Because that's a test, some people have, I tell you, the very good at that is Jake Roberts. Yeah, he'd be excellent. And I told him that years ago. Jake's got that gift. Maybe now that he's got his feet off the ground and he's getting better, who knows? Maybe they'll put him up there in that right room.
Hey, I know you're not a fan of the current president, obviously reading your Twitter. Who do you support for 2016 to be the new president?
Well, I tell you what, I'm not real sure. Ben Carson, who's not even a politician, he's a doctor, but, Ben Carson has, he's a wise man, and he says a lot of things that have impressed me. Maybe Scott Walker, the guy from Wisconsin, I don't know, some of these guys, I don't know about Rubio, Flip, again, you got to be careful with all politicians. It's kind of like I always say, how can you tell a politician's lying? I said, well, his lips are moving.
True.
I'm definitely not a fan of Obama because he's so far left And it's like, you know, I wasn't a big Clinton fan, but at least Bill Clinton was smart enough to understand that if he was going to get anything done, anything for the benefit of the country, that he had to come back to the middle. And coming back to the middle and working with Republicans, you know, he was able to balance the budget, and he accomplished some really good things. You know, this guy in 6 years hasn't accomplished yet anything. I mean, he takes credit for a lot of stuff, but it's like, I'll be honest with you, you know, all of his military leaders said, if you end this now, we're going to have to come back and do it again. And that's exactly where we're at right now, and he won't even do it now. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, it's kind of like when you're the, you know, it's like when you were a little kid, you know, the old game, King on the Hill. Well, when you're the king on the hill, everybody's gunning to knock you off the top of the hill. You know, whether you want to defend the hill or not, you have to, you know, for the good of everybody. And, you know, that's just a position that we've been placed in. So, you know, whether we want to be the policeman all over the world, we have to do, because it does serve the interests of our country as a whole. Because what a lot of people don't understand is you can't reason with these people. They don't like us. They hate our guts. They want to see us dead, period. And Obama's not even willing to call them what they are. They are Muslim extremists. They are they're fanatics that, you know, and they go by the rule of the Quran, basically. And in the Quran it says an infidel is anybody that doesn't believe in Allah and Muhammad, the prophet. And if you don't, if you're not willing to convert, then you're only worthy of one of two things: death or slavery. And so they're the extreme. They're gonna take you out. You know, the fact that he would, on the National Day of Prayer, bring up the Crusades. Are you kidding me? That just tells me how little he knows about the Crusades. Because in reality, the Crusades were the Turks. It wasn't even Arabs. It was the Turks. And they started most of that. And the Christians had to come in and finish it. So anyway, I don't need to go into a history lesson here, but just, I don't believe that. I mean, it's like every, you know, Obamacare, it's not helping anybody. I mean, and even one of the guys that wrote the thing, one of the guys, and I said this a long time ago, I said, Democrats want you to believe, the politicians want the public to believe, we're here to serve the interests of the little guy. We're here to make sure that big business and big corporations don't take advantage of you, make sure that you get a fair shake. But what they're really saying is, you, the American people, you're not smart enough to take care of yourself. Because since you're not smart enough to take care of yourself, we're going to implement all these government programs, and we're going to make sure you're taken care of equally. Everybody except us. There's not one politician on Obamacare. If it's such a good deal, and you know, like, everybody's going to be able to keep their policy, you know, and it's going to be cheaper. All it's done is gotten more expensive. But the worst of the worst is we are, what is it, almost $17 trillion in debt. Obama has accumulated more debt in 6 years than all the past presidents combined. And the clock is still ticking. And nobody up there is saying anything about balancing the budget. So, anyway. So, I mean, don't let's not go on that, because I can go on that all day.
I can tell. Yeah, I've seen my health insurance premiums go up. So the Affordable Health Care Act has done the opposite.
Anyway. As a man of God, you know what? I pray for the president every day. I really do. You know, he get wisdom, you know, or I pray that, you know, God get him out of there, you know, get somebody in there that can do something for the country. You know, because all he's interested in is politics. Every position is a political one.
That's the whole thing, though, Mr. DiBiase. I mean, who's going to take over in 2016? I don't see, as you said, with the Republicans, I don't really see anybody that's come to the forefront that's really going to be a strong challenger to, if Hillary runs for the Democrats in 2016, who's going to beat Hillary? Is it going to be Jeb Bush? I mean, I can't imagine we go back to another Bush in the future. So we really lack leadership in this country.
Yeah. Well, and I agree. you know. I mean, I'll be honest with you, you know, I thought Romney would have been a great president because he's an extremely smart businessman. But by the same token, you know, there's things about him I didn't like. And Jeb Bush, maybe not a bad president, but you know what? We've had so much Bush that I don't think anybody liked him.
True. Now, as we wrap with you, can you go ahead and plug? I know you're on Twitter. Are you on Facebook as well, Instagram, your social media? And I think at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned your websites. Can you go ahead and plug those once again? And then also any upcoming appearances you'll be making.
Yeah, the websites are milliondollarman.com and heartofdavidministry.com. And, of course, all the links to the other stuff, you know, I'm on Twitter, MDM, Ted DiBiase. I've got a public Facebook page as well. And I don't know, it's an upcoming appearance. I know that I am going to the wrestling fans, that went, well, I'm going to be at the Lexington, Kentucky Comic Con the 14th and the 15th, or 13th, 14th, and 15th of March. And then I'm going to be, well, yeah, I think I'm going to be at WrestleMania. I really haven't had that call yet, but I'm assuming anyway I'm going to be there. So. And if not on invitation by the company, then I may be out there doing, you know, do some independent stuff as well.
Awesome. Well, we do appreciate your time today. This has been a great interview. We appreciate your insight and your perspectives, and you know, we hope to talk to you again sometime.
I appreciate it, guys. I appreciate the time and the interview, and wish you well. Thanks for having me.